Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and I'm now joined by William Hartung, who is the Director of the Arms and Security Initiative at the New America Foundation. His books include How Much Are You Making on the War Daddy?, A Quick and Dirty Guide to War Profiteering in the Bush Administration, Lessons from Iraq, Avoiding the Next War, and Prophets as in the Prophet Moses, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin, and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Hartung.
Yes, thanks for having me.
And today, the Senate Armed Services Committee confirmed Leon Panetta, who's I'm sure will be voted on and confirmed by the full Senate to become the next Secretary of Defense. Now, in terms of the expectation that he's going to make the $400 billion in budget cuts that the Obama administration have promised, let's begin with his predecessor. He claims to have saved the taxpayers $300 billion, but I take it that is rather largely an illusory claim?
Yes. Basically, he fudged the numbers by taking savings from programs that were going to end anyway. He would end one program, start a very similar program. So it ends up when he is leaving office now, there are more major weapons projects than when he came in, and they cost a bit more than they would cumulatively when he came in. So not only are there no savings, but actually there's been an increase.
And how do they do this sleight of hand then? I mean, how do they move money around and make it look like they're saving? Because yesterday the LA Times carried a front page story that there's $6.6 billion of cash missing from the Iraq war that the Pentagon simply they can't account for it. They assume it's stolen, but they simply can't account for it. So with that as a kind of preface to the question, what kind of bookkeeping do they do at that place?
Well, they've never been able to be audited, so the bookkeeping is certainly not up to the task of running that kind of hundreds of billions dollar operation. And in terms of the alleged savings that Gates was talking about, the main thing is they're all savings in the future. So, it's compared to what we might have spent if we had everything we wanted. So Senator Carl Levin of the Senate Armed Services Committee asked the administration, how much of that is going to come in this current budget proposal, and how much of it is from the Pentagon versus other related agencies like Homeland Security? And they have yet to answer him. So part of the game is you keep pushing the savings off into the future and say, we will save that once we change our plan down the road.
Well, at this point, William Hartung, we're at about $800 billion a year for the defense budget?
The regular Pentagon budget and the wars is running over $700 billion. And then if you look at related things like Homeland Security and the intelligence agencies and the debt attributable to the wars and, costs of veterans benefits and so forth, then you'd be well over $1 trillion of military-related, security-related spending.
Per year at this point.
Per year, yeah.
Yeah, and we know that, I don't know whether it was deliberate or accidental, but over the years, a lot of these costs have been spread out over other agencies, haven't they? For example, the Department of Energy controls the nuclear weapons portfolio, which used to be in the Department of Defense. Transportation has the Coast Guard, et cetera.
Yes, I think there was an intention behind it, because I think the Pentagon budget is huge enough, but if it was also covering the nuclear warhead complex that's lodged in the Department of Energy, the Coast Guard has now got a new $24 billion project to outfit new fleet, new aircraft, basically an entire new Coast Guard. If that was under the Pentagon's umbrella, if we knew where they're taking the $60, $70 billion a year they spend on the intelligence community, is it hidden in the Pentagon budget? Is it separate? Where is that money lodged? If all that were in one department, it would be much larger than this record-breaking figure that exists now.
So what are the Obama administration talking about when they talk about $400 billion? at Panetta, who of course comes out of budget. He was a budget director under Clinton. I mean, he's got that's his resume, isn't it? That's his selling point here. That's why they did the musical chairs, surely. What do you think of this $400 billion promise? Is it real?
Well, they haven't given us any real examples of what's going to get cut. They've announced the number. They haven't said, you know, this weapon system's going to go, that weapon system's going to go. There are some that Gates had already said he would cancel, like the expeditionary fighting vehicle for the Marines, which will be replaced by something somewhat scaled down version of that. But those things were already in the pipeline. So allegedly this $400 billion is going to be, new cuts of some sort. And a colleague of mine, Gordon Adams, at the Stimson Center in Washington has pointed out that, you know, if the $400 billion were real, all they would have to do is freeze the Pentagon budget at the record level it's at now, let it grow for inflation, they'd save $400 billion compared to their ambitious plans. So were they to do it, it wouldn't be a huge hit on the Pentagon, but it's not clear that they're even going to do that.
So are they planning to, I guess then they don't want to announce what's going on in Afghanistan, and they can't really claim to want to save money there because they haven't made up their mind, even though it looks as though there's going to be some kind of withdrawal.
It seems like they're talking about the Pentagon's regular budget, so not the cost of Iraq, not the cost of Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
But that's where they would get these savings over the 10 years. But the trick, well, actually, it's a dozen years. They've also stretched it out. All the other plans are 10 years. Theirs is a dozen years. And then, that money, they call it security spending. So some of it could come from Homeland Security. Some of it could come from intelligence or the Department of Energy. So it's not clear that the Pentagon will bear all of that $400 billion. That's another thing that they have yet to clarify.
Well, clearly the huge change that happened with the end of the Cold War, this profound shift in the security landscape where throughout history, we've had these national wars between nation states and or alliances of nation states. And suddenly, with the collapse of the Cold War, it appears that there are no real likelihood of any great nation states facing off in any kind of world war. If anything, that threat's been replaced by subnational and transnational threats, ethnic, religious divisions, drugs, crime, guns, terrorism. That's the new landscape. And the Pentagon seems to have spent so much of like a giant super tanker, turning. They've been still spending on these useless fighter planes. It's Cold War relics, which are hugely expensive. Where would you say the mindset is now in terms of the weapons that they're buying and the changed security landscape out there? Are they back, in 1990 or 2000 or... Where would they be, do you think?
I think they're kind of an overlay. You know, in the 90s, the argument was, well, you have to fight the regional powers like Saddam Hussein or North Korea. So that's still part of the mix. Then after 9/11, you have to be able to fight terrorists, which they took a very expansive view of what that meant. Basically, any country that might harbor a terrorist was fair game. And then... There's still, there's not a Soviet threat per se, but they're starting to look ahead and say, China's the next big rival. They're building up their Navy. Therefore, we have to be prepared to continue to build up our conventional forces also. So it's sort of like they've added missions, but they haven't really given up any missions.
So what about the politics of this, William Hartung? Because I noticed that Jim Webb, who's leaving the United States Senate, who's a veteran, and he wore his son's boots, etc., and identifies with the troops as opposed to the boys and the girls, as opposed to the toys. And he and McCain, who's another veteran, they tried to get the administration to take a more realistic approach to Okinawa, which is a kind of base that they've had since World War II, where the U.S. military bases on that island, basically make it impossible for the people on the island to live. I mean, it's just overwhelming. And the recent Japanese prime minister before this current one, he thought that they could finally get the United States to relent, and he got booted out for sticking his neck out on Okinawan independence. And now Webb and McCain are saying, why don't we just consolidate these various air bases onto this one air base, and at least acknowledge a little bit of the needs of the local people. But this kind of empire mentality seems to rule.
Well, yes, there's been no talk about, why would the United States need 700-plus military bases overseas? What are they for, other than the notion that, the United States is always on the side of the angels and has to be ready to deal with any bad guy, any bad country, any bad actor anywhere in the world on short notice, as if other countries, couldn't defend themselves, and as if all of these threats really are amenable to military solutions. So it is an imperial mindset, because part of the imperial mindset is to, of course, argue that you're always on the right side, you're always, doing good for others, it's for the benefit of others, never for yourself.
But how does that gel with the fiscal realities? If the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, as he did recently, said that the deficit is a national security problem and that the Pentagon has to accept its part of the need to cut spending, where's the you can't have an empire and you can't have an empire on the cheap. I mean, I guess the Romans learned that towards the end. But what are the countervailing forces against the attrition and of empire?
Well, I think the I think there are going to be some cuts, even, whether the Pentagon wants them or not, just because of the fiscal situation. But, it hasn't quite gotten traction yet, this notion that these cuts have to be real. But a lot of the current plans, even some of the, progressive arguments are, well, we can do everything we're doing now for less. There's a lot of talk about efficiencies, cutting a weapon system there, weapon system another place, perhaps working more with allies. But the notion being same mission, same objective, just done in a slightly different way, saving some money, as opposed to why do we need all these missions? I mean, even Gates said, any president, anybody who recommends to another president to fight a major ground war like in Iraq or Afghanistan should have their head examined. But they haven't acted on that that statement. I mean, they're not saying, oh, let's scale back the size of our Marines and Army. Let's not assume we're going to have to fight one of these kinds of conflicts. Basically, they're pocketing, that money and keeping that capability, while, some are claiming that they may not ever use it.
Right. And in the meantime, the killing of bin Laden indicated to a lot of people that you don't need this huge footprint. And as much as that was celebrated, it was quickly forgotten. Right, in terms of a smaller footprint.
Yes, I mean there was more discussion of the Anthony Weiner scandal and the fact that bin Laden was killed. Right. So I think part of it is just the short-term mentality that exists. But I think also the Pentagon hasn't been held to account. To say, well, if you did this with special forces, why do you need 100,000 troops there? Iraq, of course, had nothing to do with terrorism until they got there, and then there were some terrorist groups that kind of followed the troops and developed war. So
they made themselves a target, in effect.
Exactly. And so
what about just? I just wanted to quickly get onto a couple of subjects before we wrap up here in a couple of minutes. And one of them is I recently spoke with Pierre Spray, who designed the A-10 and the F-16, which are two of the most successful weapons in the U.S. inventory. They're still being used in Afghanistan. Even though the Air Force never wanted the A-10. And in the couple of days that they were used in Libya, they were very effective. And then the minute they were taken out, the stalemate began when Obama handed this off to NATO, and they seemed to be completely feckless. And as Gates dressed them down the other day, saying, what's wrong with you guys? You know, you can't get your act together. But the long and the short of it is, what I had one of those light bulb moments with Pierre Spray, where he was explaining how they fought his very successful weapon systems tooth and nail, the bureaucracy in the Air Force in particular, and he only got it through some clever maneuvers with the Secretary of the Air Force and Defense at the time. But he said, "You don't understand, you know, kid, wake up. It doesn't matter whether these weapons work or not. And don't you think there will be a national debate if that's what's going on here, that we're spending trillions and trillions of dollars on these vast, complicated systems? And we know from what just happened with the NSA whistleblower that they spent $1 billion or so there on a total turkey that General Hayden was pushing. And they always put this guy in jail because he told the truth."
Exactly. Well, I think it is a national scandal, and I don't think it's well understood that a lot of this is driven by the military-industrial complex, by the kind of, the ideology of the armed services, that more is always better, more sophisticated is always better, even when it often ends up that simpler aircraft like the F-16 or the A-10 are in decent numbers, can do more than an F-22 or an F-35 or all these, sophisticated, costly, underperforming stealth aircraft that they're trying to outfit the force with.
So what would it take then for a cost-conscious America who's being asked to downsize and tighten their belts, and what would it take to have a national debate about what's really needed? And we don't need a Rolex; we can get by with a Timex.
Well, I think part of it's going to be driven by the larger budget debate. Some of these proposals for what they want to do with Medicare and entitlements and basic programs, not only for low-income people, but for the middle class, I think will spark some pushback of, why do we need to do this? If there's a deficit, why are we not looking at the huge amounts we spend on the military? And I think in that context, I think it would be possible to have a debate about what the military's for, not just, carving off a system here or promising to get rid of some waste over there.
Well, I guess just in closing, William Hartung, your book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex, we recently had the 50th anniversary of President Eisenhower's farewell address, and it seems to be, sort of people recognize it, that it exists, but I guess the problem is that if you combine the power of the military-industrial complex, the amount of money that they get from the taxpayer, but you have to add to that this new dimension that we have now thanks to the Supreme Court, where these big corporations can actually lobby and buy politicians with taxpayers' money. And we already see on television now Boeing and Lockheed doing these totally self-serving ads showing how patriotic they are and how much they care about the fighting men and women and how they're protecting us and we can all sleep safely in our beds tonight. And they're doing that on taxpayer money.
Well, yes. And a company like Lockheed Martin gets 98% of its money from either the U.S. government or through foreign arms sales to other governments. So pretty much anything they do is going to be on our tab. And, they've become more aggressive, audacious, and absurd in some of their advertising campaigns and some of the other things they do for members of Congress to help curry favor, not just the campaign contributions, but giving to the congressperson's favorite charity, giving to a university that's naming a chair after the person, all kinds of sort of ancillary little party favors for the members of Congress to keep them on board.
Well, now, though, the Republicans shut down an amendment that would require transparency in the amount of money they donate to candidates. So now they can literally give as much money as they like to their favorite congressman and senator who is all too willing to write the checks.
Well, yes. And also there was some talk of they should tell what they're giving to trade associations, to think tanks, to other entities that act on their behalf, and that so far has also been basically bottled up.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, William Hartung. And again, William Hartung is the author of this book, Prophets of War, Lockheed Martin and the Making of the Military-Industrial Complex. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking with a Republican about the seven Republican presidential hopefuls, how well they fared in last night's debate, and whether those who were absent stand a better chance than those who were present.
In a cage.